Our liberties we prize, and our rights we will maintain. This is Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast, where we tell stories about the contribution Iowans and the state of Iowa has made to advance the civil rights movement. Past stories are being told, present actions will be highlighted, and preparation for the future will be discussed. Here is your host, Eric Anyange.
Welcome to the Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast. J.B. Morris, one of the most influential men ever lived in the state of Iowa. He was a journalist, a lawyer, a World War I vet, and a civil rights pioneer. He is best known as the longtime owner of The Bystander, one of the nation's first black newspaper published in the state of Iowa. My guest today is his own grandson, William Morris.
So you were born and raised in Des Moines, right?
That is correct, sir.
How many siblings do you have?
I had two brothers, one older brother and one younger brother, both deceased. My brother Brad was 9 years older than me, and my brother Robert was about a year and a half younger than me.
I want to talk about your grandfather, J.B. Morris.
Certainly.
Fascinating man. Interesting
yes,
man.
Was born the son of slaves in 1890. His parents, Joseph William Morris, whom I'm indirectly named after, he was born a slave in DeKalb County, Georgia in 1859. His wife, my great-grandmother, Salima Morris, was born a slave in 1864. They married, I think, in 1881 or 1882. And then my grandfather was one of three boys, just like I was one of three boys. And so his older brother, William H. Morris, was born 1885, I believe. And he died in Salt Lake City, Utah. He was a prosperous businessman there and owned a farm. He was married, but he and his wife never had any children. But he was a very prosperous businessman there, and he died in 1971, I think. And then my grandfather was the middle one. He died in 1977. And then he had a younger brother, Clyde Edward Morris, who was a godly man. He died. He was the last one. He died in 1993, at age 93. He died in 1980, but about 1980 or so. But yeah, they grew up in, they were born in Covington, Georgia, right outside Atlanta.
Okay.
And their father abandoned the family in 1900. Now, the rumor was he went up to Tennessee and had another family. But my great-grandmother, Salima, had to raise three boys. The oldest one, the family legend, she got a little abusive. And so my Uncle Bill, well, my grandfather's oldest brother, ran off at 15 and ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah. My grandfather went up to Baltimore, and his mother's brother had bought a printing shop from a white man there. And so he became a printer, and he taught my grandfather the printing trade. And later, my grandfather enrolled at Hampton Institute, which at that time was an industrial arts school. So he graduated there with a degree in printing, professional printer's permit, and then went on to Howard Law School. But anyway, a friend of his invited him to Iowa, George Woodson. At that time, my grandfather was working on the railroad because there weren't a whole lot of jobs for black lawyers in those days.
Him and George Woodson, they knew each other?
Oh, yes. George Woodson was a former Buffalo soldier. He served in the 25th U.S. Infantry against the Apache in the Indian Wars. And he was a co-founder of the Niagara Movement. He was president of the Mahaska County Bar Association and was a very feared trial lawyer. Woodson was a co-founder later of the National Bar Association. Was a very well-respected lawyer, ran for office on the Republican ticket. He did not win. He was one of the five or six co-founders of the National Bar Association in 1925. And then it was known as the National Negro Bar Association.
Yeah. So you say he came to Iowa after he graduated from Howard in 1914, 1915 there?
Yeah.
Okay.
He, like I said, he was working on the railroad between Baltimore and Montana, Billings, Montana, and originally was intending to settle in Billings, Montana, but he was very bothered by the government's treatment of the Native American there. And so he said, you know, I've seen enough racism, so did not want to go back to Atlanta. So he located in Des Moines at Woodson's invitation. His fiance joined him. They were married, my grandmother, Georgine Crow Morris. They married in 1918, right before he shipped out for France in World War I. They got married, and they were married for almost 60 years. He died in 1977, and she died about 8 months earlier. So They had my father and his sister, Jean Mary Morris Washington, and then my grandmother was very active in NAACP and in the civil rights movement in her own right, and she founded the Iowa Nebraska Council of NAACP branches. She told me back when Roots came on, she said she was almost lynched down here in Houston, Texas, when she came down to attend an NAACP conference meeting there. I happened to find just the strange things work. I was teaching school and happened to pick up one of the classroom books, and it talked about the civil rights period in Texas, and it had a picture of all those people at the 1941 NAACP conference, and there was my grandmother with us.
And your grandma was in there? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I want to go back about your great-grandfather quick. Okay. So you say he left the family somewhere around 1900, which that'll put your grandfather about 10 years old?
Yes, he was somewhere 10 years old.
10 years old?
I don't believe he ever saw his father again.
Oh, that was my question. They never reconnected?
As far as I know, no. He died in 1919. That was the same year my father was born. And and that information came from the census. Now, I've spoken with some Morrises from Tennessee because the story was he went up over the border into Tennessee and had another family. In those old days, you know, we can't go back any farther than 1859 because his people were slaves on the plantation of Captain Nimrod Morris of DeKalb County, Georgia. He was a slave owner and had fought in the War of 1812. And his son served in a Georgia artillery regiment in the Civil War. You know, it's interesting how so many African-Americans came from very humble beginnings, but went on to accomplish incredibly great things. That's been our legacy in America. Despite racism, violence, discrimination, Jim Crow, poll taxes, literacy tests, we have overcome. And we have helped build this country. We've established businesses, schools. You know, you have African-Americans in every area of endeavor in this country. Going back to colonial times, you had three blacks in this country, like James Fortin, who became one of the wealthiest, probably at his time, the wealthiest black man in this country. And he made sails for sailing ships. You had Magdalena Walker, a black woman that chartered a black bank in Richmond, Virginia in 1902. That was only 35 years after the end of the Civil War. And that bank, I think it was called the St. John's Penny Bank, it survived the 1920s, survived the Depression until it merged with another bank. But, you know, black people have done so much in this country, and I hate to see people just constantly tearing it down. You know, yes, like I say, yes, there's racism. We still have problems. You've got incredible stories of bravery coming out of these black men, free and escaped slave. But we have to understand that everyone has encountered discrimination and racism in different degrees, but we've overcome it. And this nation is a lot stronger because of it. And if you can go to Washington, D.C. and look at the people in the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. Look at people in state legislatures, police chiefs, county sheriffs, boards of supervisors, boards of education, city councils, mayors. All these people, we've got incredible representation of African-American men and women all over this country, north and south. And, you know, yes, we still have a ways to go, but we're in a position now that our ancestors couldn't even dream about. And we need to teach that to our children. When they turn on the TV, they see the drug dealer, the pimp, the athlete, and all this other stuff, but they don't see the black man or woman who's built a legitimate business, who worked hard and played by the rules. They don't want to glorify that. They want to glorify dysfunction. They don't want to glorify those who have done well.
Do you think that's by design? What do you think that's the reason behind that?
Yes, I do. I really do. I think the majority media has been a part of this. They have shown a distorted version of African-American men and women. Now, there were times when it was starting to change. During the 60s and 70s, we saw more positive portrayals. You know, we had the Cosby Show later on. We had various things like that. A lot of them were sitcoms, but I fear that the hip-hop movement, not all of it's bad, but, you know, some of it's fine, but it encouraged these young men to look at joining gangs, to selling drugs, telling these young girls you got to shake your behind, that you can get a man, and they, you know, we have flipped what we originally educated or taught to be good and bad. The Bible says, "Woe to when men call evil good and good evil."
I could talk to you about Black history all day long, but I want to go back to your grandfather first. Like you say, he was a lawyer, journalist, and he was a military man.
Yep. And civil rights activists, he was.
And civil rights activists, he served his country. Yes, graduated from Howard in 1914, 1915, comes to Iowa. Because he graduated from law school in, or did he go to law school in Iowa? Where did he go to law school?
No. He went graduated to law school in Howard. Howard University Law School in Washington, D.C. Then he came out to Des Moines at the invitation of George Woodson, who was also a Howard Law grad. He was selected for officer's training at the Fort Des Moines training camp, the 17th Provisional Training Camp in 1917. And he was commissioned a second lieutenant and sent overseas in late May of 1918, and he served till the end of the war. He came back. He had served as assistant Polk County treasurer and was active in Republican politics. Bought the Iowa Bystander from John Lay Thompson in 1922 and owned and edited it for over 50 years. And my brothers and I used to go down and on Thursday evening after school, we'd hand fold those papers. And then they with other guys, we'd bundle them up and take them to the post office. His voice was the voice of Black Iowa because he had news from all over the state. You know, Black churches, Black fraternal and sororal organization. You know, what was going on in the Black community. You know, Blacks in the military, Blacks in business, et cetera, et cetera. And he documented the history of the Black community in Iowa for over 50 years.
Why did he want to buy the Bystander?
Originally, he wasn't going to, but John Lay Thompson wanted to sell it, and he didn't have any ready buyers. And since my grandfather was a trained printer, remember, he came out of Hampton with as a printer's apprentice. He thought that was a natural, and my grandfather bought it, figuring that it would be good for his law business and for his political career. And it was because every election, he ran, you know, the political ads were very lucrative. They would advertise with him at Christmas time. And the Black community was substantial in those days. At Center Street, you had Black restaurants, pharmacies, doctor's offices, lawyer's offices, you know, insurance companies. We had Black pharmacists. James Wardlaw Mitchell, originally from Atlanta, was our first Black licensed pharmacist in Iowa. And I knew he and his wife, Azalea, very well.
The Bystander started, what, 1894?
1894, that is correct. Founded by John Lay Thompson, who was also a lawyer.
And your grandfather picked up in 1922.
That is correct.
And he ran it until when? Because I want to come 1972. Was he the longest person to run it?
Oh, yes, by far. By far. Oh, yes. Okay. By far. That paper is still in publication.
It's online only, is it?
Yeah, online only. Yeah, a good friend of mine, Roderick Bradley, runs it. I played football with him at North High School. But yeah, he's running it now, doing a fine job.
Okay, I want to read something from the book Outside In on the chapter of the Black media in Iowa where your brother Robert V. Morris wrote, and I want to get your take on it.
Sure.
Nowhere in America has the Black press played a more critical role of communicating between the widely spread communities of Black citizens than in the state of Iowa. You stand behind your brother's work?
Yes, sir. Definitely, 100%, because you had African Americans all over the state in agriculture, in small business, in education. When I was writing my chapter on military history, I would get calls from white people way up in Northwest Iowa saying, "We had a Black veteran up here from the Civil War. We had a Black veteran here from World War I." And I was able to follow these guys and get biographical information on them. And that's how I was able to develop the biographies that I did on a lot of these guys. And these men went on to be successful businessmen, farmers. You had Black policemen in Des Moines as late as in the late 1870s.
Wow. Yeah, they say Iowa Blacks residents learn of each other through the press.
Yes, that is true.
Through the Black press.
That is true. There were other Black newspapers around the state, but most of them didn't last very long. The Bystander was the longest and best funded. My grandfather told me a story years ago about he almost went out of business during the Depression. 1934-35, you know, money was tight. At one time, the Ku Klux Klan tried to shut down his newspaper. They tried to buy it from him, and he refused. So they threatened him with firearms. I still have his 12 gauge Winchester pump shotgun, 1897. I still have that gun.
They tried to buy it?
Yeah, they offered him $5,000. He refused to take it. That was a lot of money back then. But he wouldn't take it. He wouldn't take cash money. He wouldn't take it.
Why do you think they wanted to buy it? So they can kill it?
Yeah, they wanted to shut it down or change it because he was documenting all these lynchings around the country that the Klan was doing in the 1920s. Remember, after World War I was the Bloody Red Summer of 1917 and the rise of the 20th century Ku Klux Klan. They had almost 5 million card-carrying members nationwide by 1926. The Klan ran a candidate for governor in Iowa in 1926. Now, he didn't win, but they were very politically influential. Hugo Black, who later became a U.S. Supreme Court justice, was a South Carolina Klansman. He was elected to the U.S. Senate from South Carolina in 1926. And in 1939, Franklin D. Roosevelt appointed him to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's just, oh yeah, the Klan was very influential in Iowa. They weren't as powerful as they were in Indiana or in the South. But He had to sneak into his office at midnight and print that paper, get it bundled up, and get out of there before the sun came up, because the Klan would be patrolling the streets. And so, it was a tough deal. It was a tough deal. Man. And then But during the 1930s, he told me, he had missed a couple of issues because he was almost bankrupt. And the editor of the Des Moines Register and Tribune, Harvey Ingham, called him into his office. He said, I see you missed a couple of issues. My grandfather told me he's having financial trouble. He said, look, he reached by, he gave him a $100 bill. He said, here's a list of 12 men to call on. You tell them that I sent you over there. Every one of those guys gave my grandfather at least $100. One of them gave him $300, and a couple of them gave him $200. Oh, really? So at the end of the day, he had $1,500, which was a lot of money during the Depression. That's how the bystanders survived.
And these were white folks.
These were white men. Yeah, prominent businessmen. Yeah.
Now, there was a lot of newspaper from 1881 until bystanders started in 1894. Mm-hmm. Almost all these newspapers died in a short period of time, except the bystander. What was the secret there?
My grandfather had relationships with a lot of businesses who advertised with him, black-owned, Jewish-owned businesses that advertised with him. Of course, because he was active in the Republican Party, that was able to give him some advertising business, particularly during election times. He had good relations with a lot of the elected political people, and as well as with the local statewide newspaper, the Des Moines Register and Tribune. So because there was a sizable black business population in Des Moines, that's what kept him going. And that he employed young black boys to deliver the paper by hand. You throw it on your front porch. He employed black girls in his business after school to type, to set type, to sell subscriptions. He gave prizes for blacks who kept well-maintained yards. Oh, yeah. He gave neighborhood awards for neighborhoods that kept good yards and kept their houses up. He gave prizes for black kids who got good grades in school. And like I say, he publicized black fraternities and sororities, the Masonic lodges, all that, the social history of the churches. All together, that, and plus my grandmother's connections, because she did a lot of sewing for wealthy white women and Jewish women in town. She'd been what they call a modiste. And so she would hand sew these elaborate pearl and diamond wedding gowns for these wealthy women and their daughters. And she had a business handle the whole wedding, not just the dress, but the food, the drink, the decorations, everything. So she made a substantial amount of money doing that. And was because she had been out east and had she taught textiles at Virginia Institute of Technology. And that's where she met my grandfather. Mm. He was at Howard at the time.
Oh, okay. That was my second question. How did they meet? Met.
Yeah, my grandmother was an octoroon, so she was extremely fair-skinned. She could pass for white, red hair, green eyes, and freckles. Her first husband was white. Oh, she had one son for him. She divorced him and married my grandfather, who was a very dark brown-skinned man, and they had two children. But she could easily pass for white, and the NAACP used her to move in the South with about 12 other really fair-skinned women because they were well-dressed, they were well-educated, the police would not stop them because they didn't suspect they were black. And so they helped organize NAACP chapters all over the South.
Wow. Wow. How many kids did your grandfather, J.B. Morris, had?
He had, because he lived with them during the Depression. a man named Olger Morris, and I'm Odo Morris. And so I'm thinking that he had a son before he married my grandmother. So it's possible he had three children, two boys and a girl. But my grandmother, with Georgine Crow, he had two children, my father and his sister. And my dad had three boys.
Okay.
And his sister had a boy and a girl.
I want to go back to the bystander. Mm-hmm. What happened to the black media today?
Well, we had BET, but that was bought out by Time Life. And you had some successful black entrepreneurs. You had Percy Sutton was the godfather of black cable television in New York State back in the 1970s and early 80s. And he was a millionaire. But I think over time, the expense and the dedication that it took, the time it took to run these newspapers, and plus people don't read that much anymore. Even white newspapers are going out of business. And in the black community, there are still in public. There are black newspapers here in Houston, Texas. There are black newspapers still, Chicago Defender, Pittsburgh Courier, Atlanta Journal, I think. But there are still a few that still survive. But when African Americans went out to the suburbs, we lost a lot of our sense of community. And I think that was the beginning of a slow decline for many African Americans. The rise of the ghettos, the black working class held it together. But when the automobile plants started closing, that was the death knell of really the black working class. A lot of black men and women worked in these automobile plants in Detroit and in many other places. I think the riots after Dr. King was killed in 1968, there are areas of this country. If you go down to East St. Louis and several other, there are areas of this country that were destroyed in the riots in 1968 and never rebuilt. We have forgotten our commitment. You know, it used to be blacks had to do business with each other. But whites saw that there was a lot of money being turned over there. And then the way to get at that was desegregation. So blacks that could afford it moved out to the suburbs. They took their money with them. And that's still a considerable problem today, because the gross national product of black America eclipses that of many foreign nations. But what is that? We don't turn our dollars over with our own people anymore. And that's been the biggest problem. That's why you see Hispanics prospering, because they have large families and they're turning the dollar over in their communities. That's how the Jews came up. The Jews did business with each other and they turned the dollars over in their own communities. And that's changed.
Do you think we lost the sense of community?
Yes, sir. I believe we do. I believe we did. I think desegregation probably did more harm to African Americans than it did good.
Why you think we cannot build this business? Because the money is not the issue. The money is there.
Well, the money is there, but just like my grandfather told me, if you think you're going to stay in business just with black business, you're going to go broke. You're going to have to advertise to the larger community, to whites, Hispanics, Asians, everybody. And you're going to have to offer a competitive product, competitive service. You have to know your stuff. And it's not all racism. You have to prepare yourself. And that's what I keep telling these kids in these schools. The sky is the limit for you. There are more opportunities for young people of color now, male and female, than there ever have been in this country. But you have to get prepared. You have to get your education. You have to get job experience. You don't always need a college education. Sometimes you do, but you don't always have to. There were more black men and women in medical school in the 1940s and 50s than there are now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Your grandfather ran the bystander from 1922. He owned and ran it from 1922 all the way to 1971.
Actually, 1972. He got it back. He sold it to a guy who didn't know how to run it. And so he got it back because the guy defaulted on the payments. He had a contract to buy the newspaper. He ran it for a little while, sold it to another guy. And then he ended up having trouble. And then it was bought by the West Des Moines newspaper group. Lauren Sampson, the West Des Moines the newspaper group, bought the bystander. And then for a while, my younger brother and I worked on that. We worked on and published that paper and distributed it for several years in the 1980s. And we had a chance to buy it. But my brother was getting into TV and I had started my law practice. And so, you know, that's something you have to that's a hands-on. You know, 10-hour day job. Yeah, you can't just do that part-time.
Basically, the newspaper kind of fell off after it left your grandfather's hands.
Yeah, it did a little bit.
Did you say that?
For a while, but my younger brother and I brought it back up, and it was the West Des Moines Shopper Network. That's what I meant to say. Lauren Sampson's group had that, and he worked with us, and we built the Bystander back up in advertising and in circulation. And then after he, my brother and I left there, it continued to be published, and then Roderick Bradley kind of resurrected it years ago, and then for a while it was available in print, but because of the expense of that and postage and distribution, now it's just online, but it's still in publication. So it's still the oldest black newspaper west of the Mississippi.
Right between that time and his buying the newspaper in 1925, he was one of the founders of the National Negro Bar Association.
That's right, National Negro Bar
and
Association.
And he did that with George Woodson and Samuel Joe Brown and Gertrude Rush.
Yep. At that time, the American Bar Association would not accept African-American lawyers. So they founded that because, again, black lawyers were on the forefront. You know, I tell you, that was the rise of the 20th century Ku Klux Klan. There were race riots and killings all over this country. The NAACP had been founded in
1905?
No, I think it was like 1909, I think it was NAACP. But in any event, there were a lot of court cases going on at that time, but it was very dangerous for black lawyers in many cases because they would be threatened. Judges would question their certifications, whether they'd ever pass the bar. So a lot of lawyers, particularly in the South, they had to carry their credentials with them. They'd have to carry their certificates of graduation from law school and their certificates of admission to the bar in the state where they practice. Today, the National Bar Association is the largest organization of black and other non-white lawyers in the nation. The ABA did start admitting black lawyers, I think, in the early 1930s. Interestingly, in Iowa, black doctors were able to integrate more successfully initially than black lawyers. You had Dr. Scales, I think, was the chief of staff at Mercy Hospital back in the 1950s. And then you had a number of other prominent black physicians. The Harper family from Fort Madison produced several generations of medical doctors, and they were very distinguished. And, you know, there's a legacy of black professionals all over the state of Iowa. But these men and women had to really do the do. You know, Gertrude Rush was the first black woman to practice law in Iowa, and she had offices in Des Moines, in Buxton, Iowa, and in Chicago, Illinois. And my grandmother told me that she and Mrs. Rush ran a clinic for pregnant black girls back during the Depression.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Your grandfather was well known as J.B. Morris.
That's right.
I know J is James. What does B stand for?
The B is for Braddy. He was
Braddy.
James
Braddy,
B-R-A-D-D-I-E. He and my father had the same name. But my older brother is James Brad Ford Morris, B-R-A-D-F-O-R-D. So he was James B. Morris III, but his middle name is Brad Ford.
What do you think J.B. Morris will think about the state of the black people today?
I think he would be encouraged by the fact that we've had a black president. We have a biracial vice president. We've had a large numbers of African Americans in politics at the federal, state, county, municipal level. I think he would be appalled at the social condition of black America. He would be appalled at the rise of the gangs and the killings, of the rise in black out-of-wedlock births. I think he would be shocked at the portrayal of African Americans in the media. I think he'd be shocked at these rap videos. I think he'd be shocked at the behavior of a lot of kids in schools these days and the way they dress. Every positive comes with a negative, unfortunately. And so, like I said, I think he would be, he'd be encouraged in one regard, but he'd be very disheartened in other regards. I think I can hear his voice. I think if he came, he'd say, "What has happened to the Negro? What has happened to my people?" And I think that's what he'd say. And like I say, he would be surprised and pleasantly surprised at what African Americans have accomplished. The wealth, the fact that blacks have built so much, that's great, but it's come at a cost, and I don't know if it was worth it. I think the condition of African Americans in the schools, not all schools, but I noticed I was looking at a report the other day, 80% of the young people in the public schools in California cannot read or write at grade level or do math at grade level. And in North Philadelphia, there was a primarily black elementary school. Only 5.5% of the students were competent in math at the fifth grade level. We're creating a generation of young men and women who are not socialized to succeed in the conventional sense. And one of the schools I taught in Houston ISD, 35% of the girls already had babies. Very few of the kids had ever worked a job yet. And so I was trying to get them to used to the fact, you know, if you come to school late to school, you're going to come late to the job. And when you do that enough, they're going to fire you. You have to learn to be on time, groom yourself. If you're going to be a success, you have to change the way you talk, change the way you act, and change the way you dress.
What is your thought, and I don't want to get into it too deep, but what is your thought about the woke movement? Do you think it helps Black community
no,
or it hurts?
No, I think it hurts them. I think that and even CRT and some of those others, it makes Black people think they're victims. They can't do anything about it. But the system is horrible. The system's corrupt. I'm oppressed. I'm a victim and I can't do anything about it. I think that's bad. I think it cripples these young people in their imaginations and in their drive. It gives them too much of an excuse. Well, I'm Black, so I'm oppressed and I'll never succeed. That's garbage.
Yeah.
You know, even before this country was established, that Black people were successful.
What would you say the legacy of J.B. Morris, your grandfather, in Iowa?
He left a legacy of accomplishment, legacy? Of hard work, of patriotism, of family, and community. There's a school, there's an elementary school named for him on the south side of Des Moines. There's a road near the Fort Des Moines Museum named it for the Morris family. There's the Morris Scholarship Fund, which was established right after he died in 1977. The Morris Scholarship Fund was established initially for Black students in law and journalism. Now it's open to minorities in every stage of, in every field of endeavor. So that's still operating. He was a great advocate for education, but he was also an advocate for community, an advocate for young people, for business, but you had to do it the right way. And he constantly lectured me and my brothers about duty, about, you know, you got these rights, but you also have a duty to, you know, vote, to participate in the community, to serve on boards and commissions, to obey the law, to respect the police. You know, as a lawyer, you know, there's police brutality, there's police misconduct. But rather than, you know, burning down your own city, why don't you, you know, get somebody elected to office, file a complaint, file a lawsuit. There are ways to go about it through the system. You don't have to burn down a city to do it. And I know there's a lot of rage after George Floyd died, and there's the various other killings around the country. But the aftermath of it, but what has been the improvement in the status of African Americans? Now, we have had some more Blacks elected to office, and that's been good. And there's been more emphasis on African American history in the schools. And I think businesses are being more sensitive to hiring African Americans. But at the same time, that we're not reaching the young people that need it the most.
Yes.
They still feel trapped. They feel nobody cares. The important thing in the Black community is not only education, but the status of the Black family and helping these young people prepare for the job market. We need to own our own businesses and train our young people. So we have to understand this is still a capitalist society. You have to be able to compete in a business sense.
Yep.
And not everything is racism. You have to be able to prepare yourself and compete in business. You have to prepare. You have to have a product or a service that there's a demand for and that you can offer at an affordable price. So it's, you know, it's challenging, but we can get through it. We can get through it. But we're going to have to put our heads together. Yep. And do what's right for the country and do what's right for our young people. So, you know, there's always hope for America. You just, you know, you pray, you got to do what's right.
Yeah. Thank you for your wise words there.
Well, thank you for having me, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks for sharing your story about your grandfather, J.B. Morris, his contribution to the country, to the state of Iowa. And I appreciate for you joining the show today and share his story.
Well, it's an honor, and I appreciate the opportunity. I love to tell his story, and I think more people should hear about it. But I think young Black people all over the country need to know about it, and not just him, but all these other Black men and women that have come before us who have done great things and are doing great things right now.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah, we need to get that out there. So thank you for having me, sir.
Amen. Thank you, man. That was William Morris, the grandson of J.B. Morris. Thank you, sir.
God bless you. Thank you.